Hey, it's the Schwarzenegger. I need your clothes, your boots, and your podcast device. Why? Because this October, on the Films and Swearing Movie Podcast, the boys will be reviewing all 5 Terminator movies. Yes, all 5. Even Rise of the Machines, Talk to the Hand, and search Films and Swearing on your podcast apps, iTunes, Skynet, and Stitcher Radio, or visit filmsandswearing.com. If not, consider it a divorce.
That's fucking Tom Rico.
Fuck you, asshole.
Welcome to Podcast on Fire 202 on Game of Death. And in the wake of Bruce Lee's death, there was popularity at its peak right there. And savvy producers, high profile or not, started to exploit the image of him by casting other people looking semi-similar to him or not similar at all. Hence your Bruce Lus, Bruce Lies, Dragon Lee and so forth. When Golden Harvest decided to try and structure a movie around Bruce's unfinished movie Game of Death, the result was big and high profile, and find out in this episode how this attempt at honoring the late great Lee fared, as several actors playing Lee, along with footage from elsewhere, gather for 1978's Game of Death. My name is Kennedy, and with me to discuss this and find out if he is a Bruce Lee fan or not is East Screen West Screen's Paul Fox. So say hi, buddy.
Wow.
Sorry.
my best worst Bruce Lee impression. And I won't do that anymore during this podcast, I promise.
Yeah, the guys who dubbed the footage in this movie, they took it and ran with it. Like that guy did it a lot during the end stretches of the fight. Like, it's getting pretty tiring, guys. So, Paul, you haven't been on some, well, you're semi-frequently on, but you were on the big grand Podcast on Fire 200. Now we're back in the regularly scheduled flow, and we're only doing one movie, so I'm changing around things and making briefer shows. So even inspired by you, because your podcast, East Screen, West Screen, is a good hour chunk of great substantial news and a great solo format, a solo review format as well. Whether you think so or not, I think so. So that's my little ode to you, and you might as well plug your podcast as well.
Yes, thank you, sir. And that is high praise coming from a man and a podcaster that I admire greatly. As anyone who listens to this show will know, you've been a continuous inspiration for me and continue to be so. So yes, East Screen, West Screen is our podcast. It can be found over at concast.com. And we've kind of changed the format over the years since we've come back after a brief hiatus. And we used to do a couple movies every week, trying to focus on a Hong Kong movie and a Hollywood movie. Now we've kind of limited ourselves to one movie and some news each week, and hopefully bringing more focus and at least the same amount of entertainment value.
And there you're working on a consistent basis as well, which is always a good sign of there's passion behind the project, and you're able to get together despite having busy lives because none of us do this for a living. Obviously, we have to structure it around you, in the case of you, family life, obviously professional life, and same with Kevin as well, with his professional life being a
Mr. Jet Setting Ma. Yeah. That's what I'm calling now.
It's a nice little quick flowing nickname for him. On the airways of love, Kevin. Huh? Get it? Like, thanks. There we are. It's not a joke, by the way. Airways of love. It's not a joke.
Yes. Look at YouTube it, people. You must YouTube it.
Michael Wong set the music stage on fire, and it's sort of burning since, I guess. I love Michael. I love Michael. I love that he did his album and his video, and he wrote his own songs. That's a creator right there. You should never discourage a creator. There we are. But anyway, let's run through our contact information really quickly. This is Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. Our site is podcastonfire.com. You'll find this show on Hong Kong Cinema, either very old or slightly old, or sometimes even new movies crop up in our sub-series, The Dynasty Report, which Paul co-hosts along with me and Dr. David Lam. So make your selection over at the site. We also have bonus episodes over there. If you have any questions or feedback, we would love to hear from you on the topic of Bruce Lee. So make some comment, leave some comment. We'd love to hear some feedback. And if you have any questions, email us at podcastonfire@googlemail.com. We have a Facebook presence, like our page. We have a discussion group as well. You can just follow the links in the show post or on the website. We have buttons at the top of the page that lead you to social media, and our Twitter handle, which you can also reach from there, is at Podcast on Fire. My website, where I write about Hong Kong movies, Taiwanese movies, those funny ninja movies by Godfrey Ho and other makers of such entertainment, along with a variety of other genres, is available on SoGoodReviews.com and iVideoReview at SleazyKVideo.com, and my Twitter handle is at SoGoodReviews. And you can find us over on iTunes, so rate and subscribe, and if you have the time, please leave a written comment about the show, either on the main feed or on any other specific show on the network. If you like What's Korean Cinema, we would love to hear from you over there and so forth. And finally, stream us on Stitcher Radio, either via their website or via the applications that are available for free on the Apple App Store and Google Play. So that's that for now. We're going to take a short podcast promotional break, and we'll be back in a minute or so to review Game of Death from 1978. So sit tight and we'll be back.
They're 12 miles of bad road, and now they have a microphone and their own show. It's the Daily Grindhouse Podcast, the official podcast of DailyGrindhouse.com. Starring G.
You tell that bitch who sent you here how sorry I am I can no longer be her friend.
And the man called Perry.
I'm the one that killed Munden, whooped Tuesday, and put Wims in the hospital. All the birds did a tell five did not the birds spare Jones, son.
Reviewing the hits and the hidden from the world of exploitation, cinema, and beyond. Featuring exclusive cast and crew interviews. Past guests include John Carpenter, Robert Forster, Brian Trenchard-Smith, but still no Steve Guttenberg. we'll get him someday. We promise. I mean, we promise. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast, available on iTunes, Stitcher Smart Radio, Podomatic, and of course at dailygrindhouse.com/podcasts. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast. Tough films for the rough crowd.
Got the goddamn message? Let's go to work.
And welcome back. And the review for this episode, the only movie, because I think there's a lot to be said about Game of Death, good and bad. And it's from 1978, and plot from the Love HK review of the film, because I can't write one of these things. I look to better writers. So that's why I look at that site among other sites. But anyway, in the film, Bruce Lee, though it's mainly Korean actor Kim Tae-jung, plays Billy Lo, a sensational martial artist on the verge of superstardom in the Hong Kong film industry. Billy's got it all, fame, money, and a pretty pop singer girlfriend named Anne, played by Colleen Camp. But all is not as peachy as it seems. Into the plot comes the Syndicate, a dastardly group of crusty old white men led by the improbably named Dr. Land, played by Dean Jagger. Apparently, the sinister Syndicate wants to exploit Billy and take advantage of his burgeoning film career, or something like that. That's also part of the plot that the Love HK film writer wrote with its co-so or any of the other writers. But I'll be quiet for now. I want to hear your brief opinion of Game of Death, Paul.
Yeah, this is a film that I first encountered as a kid. I was a huge Bruce Lee fan growing up. He was a hero of mine. It's been widely documented. I mean, if you've seen any of the documentaries or read his books or even in the biographical movie Dragon, played by Jason Scott Lee, you know, there's this idea that one of the things he wanted to do with his movies is become sort of a bridge between the West and Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the sad thing is he didn't live, a full life, and he didn't get to continue creating. But what he did create did work. You know, he was a bridge for me. He he was part of the reason why I am sitting in Hong Kong right now, because he had such a powerful impact on me as a kid.
Might I ask if you ever thought about or go into training, therefore, martial arts training?
I've done training, yes.
I like that. I was never part of that, but I always liked that that spark that it creates, a very rational spark, am I that? So that's very cool.
Yeah, and his idea was, and I think this is, again, emphasized in some of the documentaries out there, that he would become, you know, he would use action in cinema and his stardom to be the thing that would attract people initially, attract Westerners and Europeans, you know, through the action to Chinese culture. But then from there, it would lead on to other things, not just, you know, martial arts, but not just kung fu, but other aspects of Chinese culture. And, you know, beyond that, to other aspects of Asian culture. And then, you know, it's a sort of, it kind of like a virus in many ways. And that's exactly what it was for me. I mean, I grew up, basically my two loves were, you know, Chinese kung fu films initiated by, you know, Bruce Lee movies and Japanese anime. You know, that was the thing that I watched on the weekends. It was the things that I grew up watching in the mornings, you know, Speed Racer, Shogun Warriors, Star Blazers, all that stuff. That's what I was fed, you know, when I would get up before I'd go to school. And that served as a very strong point of cultural context for me and what I looked to as heroes, who I admired. And I had a very different kind of childhood, you might say, as a result. So I was always a bit of an oddball. I didn't really understand this film when I first encountered it in my younger years. And it would only be later in, you know, revisits. I would start, you know, because when you're a kid, what they do in this film, they can kind of pull off.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you get older and you get, you know, a bit more schooled in the ways of visual culture, you start to notice some things are off in this film. And then, yeah, it becomes a film that quickly started out probably as one of my favorite films. Whereas, you know, I remember not really liking The Big Boss, which when I was a kid was called Fist of Fury because it got, you know, retitled. And that was another thing that always confused me as I got more into the understanding of Chinese culture and I started to realize what was happening with things like dubbing and retitling. Getting to know the films by their original titles took me a while.
Yeah. In the case of those two, apparently they were switched up, like Big Boss and Fist of Fury. Apparently that's a long-lasting mistake. The first one should have been A Chinese Connection, while the second one should have been As It Was, essentially. That's the story I heard.
He's a huge influence for me, and it was interesting to how this film started out as one of my favorite because of the very dynamic nature and some of the cinematography shots, especially in the final sequences that we get to see, and not really remembering a lot of the stuff it took to get there.
Yeah.
You know, which we will get to in a minute. But then going back now, I look at a film like The Big Boss and I admire it so much more, you know, despite the fact that, you know, it's not maybe as technically clean as what we see in the last stages of Game of Death or even something like Enter the Dragon. I admire the earlier stuff a little bit more now. And so growing up, over the years, of course, you only have this handful of films to see. And then you've got documentaries that come out, you know, a couple each decade. And, you know, we learned more and more over time, you know, as we get older. And, of course, now we've got the revelation of lost footage, even with regard to this film that I think we'll talk about a little bit later. So huge influence for me. This film, not perhaps my favorite anymore.
Yeah, when you realize the cardboard cutout aspect of this, then a lot of things sink about this one. Like, it's not an illusion anymore. For me, the version Golden Harvest completed after Bruce Lee died remains a dull, offensive film with no spark or fun present. Well, the last 10 minutes. But try and catch the 40-minute edit of the completed fight footage Lee directed before his death instead, because the vision as it is now, based on like script notes and stuff like that, truly looks like a fun and clever gem in the making that was never fully made. All of that is absent from Robert Klaus's version. Therefore, the question remains, in your opinion, should they have made this at all?
You know, I share some of the same sentiment with you, but I haven't watched this film since coming to Hong Kong. So it's been you know, more than 15 years since I've seen it. And now, having been in Hong Kong for a while, I looked at this with a somewhat pair of fresh eyes. And so there were pieces and things that I saw throughout, things that I did not recognize as well in, you know, when I was young, that I now recognize. And there are bits and parts that I appreciate. It's not enough to overcome the incompetencies of the whole package, you might say. But there are little pieces that on this viewing for the podcast, I went, oh, you know, wow, look at that. And isn't that interesting? And, oh, I know who that is now. I didn't know who that was, you know, when I was younger. And so there are these moments in the film that if they could have taken them out and made them something separate, they'd be completely awesome, right? But the fact that it's kind of tied in with some of the bad aspects of this film bring them down a little bit.
There was a good idea to conjure up this product. You know, there was a vision present in the footage that was there. And clearly, they all, you know, in international crew and obviously a local crew and cast wanted to honor the late great Lee's memory and all of that. You know, some level-headedness and good taste should have been put forth here. I think there was a good thought initially, but quickly, at least the movie has finished, reveals a dull streak and also some bad taste here that I'm not sure they were trying to be sensational and exploit Bruce Lee as such, but as we'll probably mention a couple of times, you know, we get shots from what the documentary crew for another project, I believe, shot. They shot at Bruce Lee's public funeral, you know, and as it is in the context within this movie, is that footage is fictional. It's part of the plot here, which just rings false when you mix such grave reality and real grief with their nonsense fictional plot about the Billy Lowe character faking his death and stuff like that. So they wanted to make this a swan song, clearly. You know, I get that. And having it be in English is a good train of thought, because why not? The world loves him. Loved him. And still loves him. So why not make it as big as possible? And Robert Klaus had commercial pull based on Enter the Dragon alone. I mean, I still love the movie, and he brought, you know, he brought quality to that. We get a John Barry score here, the classic James Bond composer. The opening is like James Bond in feel. It looks and feels right from the beginning, and I'm sure at the start of the production, the aim was, you know, respectable, but they couldn't really pull off a fun movie, and in certain sections they really, really personally, and I'm not dictating this, I just felt personally offended by the fact they used some of the real footage. But yeah, you know, I've seen a lot of cut and paste movies, you know, the Godfrey Ho Ninja movies. I'm used to mixing and matching footage being rather poor. Could be fun, that is poor, but what they do here is a mixed bag, I think, when they cut from the double to old footage of Bruce. You know, you have the first scene where he's on the movie set, then a light from the top of the studio falls down and nearly kills him, and you get a quick shot of Bruce, quite a zoomed in shot, because it's a shot from the Colosseum in Rome, from Way of the Dragon, where he looks up, and it's really bad and grainy cutaways to Bruce, which it must have stood out like a sore thumb even in 1978, you know, on a great big screen as well. So they're not doing a particularly good job, but that choice versus the choices as we go into the dressing room and the Billy Lowe character and Bruce Lee's double meets Hugh O'Brien, that's when something goes quite wrong. And I mean, we first see him pasted on speaking dialogue onto a body, and his face from somewhere else is pasted onto the body of the double, presumably. So you get a quick shot of him, like, how did you get in here? That's sort of fine. But when they put the still face on the mirror or on the print, that's as supposed to act as a reflection in the dressing room mirror while he looks at Hugh O'Brien, I mean, did that ever fool anyone? Did that ever fool you as a young one, Paul, when you see that still image and the double clearly trying to be in position, but it kind of is not?
Yeah, I can't dig that deep back in my memory. I don't remember it being anywhere near as glaring as I found it this time. And you know, the interesting thing is that kind of stuff is fairly common in YouTube videos these days, right? And I'm imagining what they had to go through to get that done back then, you know, in the 70s when technology was totally different. It may be an A for effort, but not much else.
Well, at least they didn't do it throughout the movie. I think, as Bay Logan said on his commentary, I think there's a reason they only did it once.
Yeah.
They wanted to keep it maybe for for storytelling purposes, but they didn't do it again because they knew back then that this is not going to work. But we'll keep it. And like, the movie was pre-sold anyway, so it's not like this was a risky project anyway. And it went on to be a success anyway. So, I mean, maybe they felt like, well, they'll forgive us. We're bringing back Bruce Lee anyway, so we'll go with it, I guess.
I guess, you know, maybe you would know this better than most. Is this, you know, we look at this during this period, and of course, you've already started talking about a lot of the Godfrey Ho stuff, the ninjas, the movies, things that have been patched together. I mean, I grew up watching, for example, Battle of the Planets, which was sort of this collusion of Gotcha Man from Japan, but also adding in new footage and cutting out some of the graphic aspects of it. And then in the 80s, we had Robotech, which was actually the collusion of three different, completely separate anime series.
Right. I didn't even know that. I rented that as a kid, and I was like, awesome, animated stuff. I didn't even know that was different sources for that one.
You know, so I'm wondering, you know, does this all come back to this film? Was this film, you know, sort of the early instigator of this kind of, you know, patchwork creation of entertainment, or are there examples that go even further back?
I think Corman did it a bit more, at least Corman did it a bit earlier with his various acquisitions, either in the 60s and 70s. I don't have any examples in front of me because I haven't seen a lot of the stuff that Roger Corman picked up, produced, and directed. But I think it goes back a little while, at least into the 70s. But I think there are better examples earlier, to be honest. That idea of cutting and pasting, mixing and matching, you know, you gotta focus on it to make it smooth. And you can always see the seams if you really want to look at it, especially if you're an amateur critic like I am and we are. But the problem here is too, not just the cutting from the concealed double to old footage of Bruce from elsewhere, these quick cuts, but throughout the movie, Paul, they seem to either forget, just neglect, or don't care at all about hiding the face of the various doubles. For instance, Kim Tae-jong or Tong Long. You see, it's essentially almost full frontal shots, you know?
They did try. I mean, they tried to keep him in the shadows a couple times, always having the glasses on, you know? And then, like, the very famous, you know, the yellow tracksuit with the black stripe that Bruce actually wears. You know, how they establish him getting that is just kind of really lame, right? Because it's a later scene where there's sort of this motorcycle clash and he knocks one of the dudes off the motorcycle who's wearing that jumpsuit, right? And then the next scene, he's now wearing it. And I'm like, oh, why would you wear some other dude's clothes, you know? And then it's because he's trying to disguise himself, and oh, how convenient, because he's wearing a helmet now, so we still can't see the face, right? The disguise doesn't actually work, right? He doesn't really fool anybody, because it's like the first guy he comes across on the motorcycle gang realizes it's not his buddy, I guess, and then, like, you know, they have a, you know, they kind of fight it out on the motorcycles. But I think they were more focused on trying to get some action beats in there, and I guess at some point maybe they realized that these guys just aren't gonna cut it. You know, it's not like they had the actor from Shaolin Soccer, right?
What's his name? God damn, did he look like Bruce Lee? That was uncanny. Yeah. What a find! There was the guy to play the goalie. Wasn't he cast as Bruce Lee in a TV series subsequently?
Yeah, I think he was in the TVB drama.
I heard that was bad, the series, but that was, like, excellent. Like, he was funny, but, like, he looks so much like Bruce Lee. It's not just because he put on the mannerisms. Like, that was uncanny. we should state it's a decently crafted and shot movie. It's not a Hong Kong quickie or anything. Speaking of casting, we got Dean Jagger as the crusty old white man, the big boss. And it's essentially like having Grandpa Simpson as the big boss. Like, at first he feeds his fish and like, ooh, ha, 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 you beautiful bastard. But he's so like, he looks so friendly and you just expect him to like fall asleep and just wake up in the middle of, doing whatever and shout, Matlock! I mean, the other guys, Hugh O'Brien, I think, does a good job. You got Mel Novak as one of the hitmen as well. Look, he's got a glare about him and stuff like that. But this guy, he wouldn't be able to scare an 8-year-old, let alone scare us as the cinema-going audience. But I guess I don't know anything about Dean Jagger, pardon me. But I guess there must have been some sort of pull there for the casting, yeah. You know, because this guy's old.
I think, you know, the interesting thing with the whole sort of later footage, I guess we'd call it, which basically just centers around, you know, this Western cast basically coming together for meetings at various points throughout the film. And I wrote in my notes, I said if they wanted an alternate title for this film, they could have called it What About Billy Lowe? That's all they do. They get together and say, what about Billy Lowe? Right. And it's like, oh, well, you know, we send some guys to beat him up and we're waiting to see what he says. And let's do it again, you know. And it's like that's the thing. It's like three times in a row or something, you know. It's like, we're gonna go rough up Billy Lowe, you know. And then they get back to the Dr. Land guy. He's like, what about Billy Lowe? Where are we with the Billy Lowe situation? Yeah, it's like so nonsensical in some ways that these guys would just kind of, you know, get together and have this conversation. We do get a couple points that I think worth pointing out. You noted before that Colleen Camp is here as Anne Morris, the girlfriend. Was never a big, huge Colleen Camp fan, but I do give this movie kudos for pushing the Asian male, white female, quote-unquote romance,
mm-hmm.
Which I think back in this day and age was not something that Hollywood was very big on. I mean, they had a hard enough time getting Bruce Lee into an actual leading role. But the interesting thing, too, is that, all right, yeah, they're in a romance, but we don't actually see any real kind of physical romance between them. It's mostly she's a damsel in distress in periods, and, you know, their relationship is talked about, but it's never really truly shown.
Do you think there was some kind of like, well, this is going out internationally, we are like, no matter how horrible, it might sound horrible, but do you think there was still some hesitation to portray it intimately and romantically?
Yeah, if that would be my guess, that, you know, they were okay saying, all right, they're a couple, but let's not, you know,
they're buddies, essentially.
go too far beyond that, which is interesting when we get to talk a little bit about the second film, because there's a, yeah, we'll get to that.
There's a naked chicken that one, people.
We do get the return of Dan Inosanto and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And this is, again, to shoot new footage.
That was apparently a double. The Kareem Abdul-Jabbar character they show earlier in the film in Shadows.
Oh, that's not him.
Apparently, I'm basing my thoughts, listeners, on the commentary that Bay Logan provided. And he was apparently asked, but sensed that there was some kind of exploitation going on that he personally did not want to be part of. So I'm fairly certain, because they never showed his face, right? So I'm fairly certain that it is a double, that they shot from a particular angle to make him look as giant as Kareem looked.
Well, there is an interesting shot after the, you know, the final fight with Kareem. And there's a scene where Bruce is getting ready to go up to the next level, and we've at that point run out of the Bruce footage, so we're back to the faux Bruce footage. The end of that sequence, he's knocked Kareem out face forward, like over a table or something. They've got a shot of the faux Bruce there, and just some guy, not even there, he's like wearing black leggings, he's not even the same color as, wow, Kareem's legs were, and he's just kind of lying there on the floor. And I just saw that I just had to pause it and started cracking up, you know. It's just like, oh, we can't even get the body double somewhat close, but
just him with his ass in the air, essentially, which is like very unflattering, but there it is.
Yeah, pretty much. But we do get some great Hong Kong cast at a couple points. You have Roy Chow here as the uncle. I think it was his uncle who's an opera troupe performer. He's only got a very sort of brief cameo. The thing here, too, is I'm watching this and he's speaking English.
Yeah.
And he's dubbed.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, my God, you guys, you get Roy Chow, who's got great English. I mean, if you've ever seen or heard him speak in English, he's awesome. And he's there. He's acting for you. And you dub him.
I wonder why, because it's a partly sync sound movie. And I'm thinking, because at that point, and it shortly leads us into talking of the various actors that play Bruce Lee. At that point, they have the still apparently uncredited, but Bay Logan said it was possibly a businessman playing Bruce or Billy Lowe in the acting scenes. And it's him acting versus Roy Chow. And I wonder if they just didn't want to have a one-side sync, one-side dub.
Maybe. But I was just, that annoyed me so much.
I know. I mean, you see Temple of Doom, of course, his brief role in that. But I remember Mike Leader said of Roy, because he met him at least one time, at least, working in the industry, that Roy always had this fascination with anyone who spoke English, who was from an English-speaking territory that he or country, that he always was interested in the language and the origin and things like that. And I always liked that story about Roy, that that was kind of a hobby, I suppose, and just a general interest. And by all accounts, you know, he escaped death so many times, and he was in a couple of accidents and had a stroke, I believe, and he became quite a devoted Christian at the end of his life, I believe, before he passed away.
Yeah.
Saw Summer Snow, by the way, recently, just to rewatch that. That's still like great that he got that performance in at the near the end of his life, or a couple of years away before he died, because that's quite a wonderful movie that's also kind of buried. It's not like on DVD and Blu-ray and stuff in Hong Kong. What a shame, because like internationally recognized Hong Kong cinema, and we cannot just forget about it. But there it is. Game of Death, on the other hand, it's out there, warts and all.
Another, perhaps a gem. I could be wrong in this. I did try to scan through IMDb and some other sources. Maybe you can confirm or deny this. I do believe James Hong is here dubbing a couple of the minor characters, both in English and in Cantonese.
I remember Bay saying that as well, yeah.
I picked up on his very distinctive voice, and I said, it's got to be James Hong. But when I did a scan, they don't credit him in either place, either on his own IMDb page or in the film's IMDb page.
Yeah, maybe it was one of those. Maybe the rules were a bit looser then, that if you were dubbing, you weren't going to get credited as such. Nowadays, they wouldn't dream of missing a credit like that, because the rules are and unions are that way. So I'm pretty sure that they might have just left him out, and they could, unfortunately. Speaking of, again, Bruce, just to repeat some info that you possibly all know, but we'll say it anyway. As I said, in some of the acting scenes with Colin Camp and what have you, apparently they cast some businessman of some kind that was discovered, who kind of looked like Bruce Lee, often wears glasses, for some of the acting scenes. And clearly he's speaking English, it looks like, anyway, in those scenes. The main fighting double for Bruce, either in just the fighting footage or some of the regular footage where he's in the frame doing whatever, is the Korean actor Kim Tae-jong, aka Tong Lung, which I forgot about this before I was refreshed on that fact. That is actually the character name of Bruce in Way of the Dragon. So he got himself a sort of stage name that is on prints like the Hong Kong version of Tower of Death. It's Tong Lung. And he turned up in No Retreat, No Surrender, playing the ghost of Bruce Lee. That was Kim Tae-jong. Like, wow, what a career. I mean, that's just marvelous nonsense in a very, I like No Retreat, No Surrender, but my God, what an idea. Bring back the ghost of Bruce Lee as part of that character's training. Like, not a Sifu or anything like that, but bring back a ghost. Awesome. Because as you all know, that was a Hong Kong production after all, with seasonal films and things like that. Fighting acrobatic double for the more complex martial arts moves is Yuen Biu. You can see Yuen Biu pretty clearly in a couple of shots, especially nowadays with the DVD quality, and maybe on the Blu-ray as well. You can see Yuen Biu, and he makes the action look quite awesome, and it's also directed by Sammo Hung, the action direction in general. So there are a couple of gems here in terms of the action that I'm sure we'll get to. But my question to you is, does anyone at all, at any point, aside from Bruce, look like Bruce Lee to you?
I'd have to say no. except maybe the paper cutout.
Yep.
That's the closest they get. You kind of want to give it a pass because you do, you know, especially when I've seen some of the documentaries where they interview like Sammo. It looked like Sammo was going at this in an attempt to really try and, you know, at least get the action in line with Bruce's style of action. And the style of action is a point that I'll come back to in the next episode when we talk about, you know, the second film. Sammo has a fight scene himself with the character Carl, which I think is great, you know, and I'm looking at that and I'm going, oh, this is like the, you know, Ip Man fight with Mr. Twister only, you know, decades earlier.
Yeah.
You know, and it's great. It's good stuff. It's not Bruce Lee, but it's really good Sammo. It's a really good Sammo fight scene, you know, so there is stuff that's here to appreciate for Hong Kong cinema fans. There's also some great cheese in the movie. I mean, you know, Carl has this line after the fight. He walks into his locker room and there's a blonde girl sitting there. He says, "Who are you?" She says, "I'm June." He says, "This is my new girlfriend. I'd like you to take plenty of pictures of her."
I love that. Where are you from? Kansas City.
You don't ever see her again. It's just like this crazy sort of like one liner that just,
and he picks her up like furniture, essentially, and puts her on the table. "This is now my girlfriend." And I laughed so loud. And I would have loved for the movie to be that unintentional cheese a little bit more. But Robert Klaus makes this movie so damn boring at points. And in other action aspects, like the Bob Wall fight with Yuen Biao and Tong Long, because they're all in it after this. And the ring fight with Sammo and Bob Wall, really the highlights. But in other sequences, like when the henchmen turn up at the opera where Bobby Lowe, Billy Lowe, is having a chat with Roy Chow and what have you, I'm looking at it and I'm not sure Sammo was calling the shots at all times, because the shots and editing in some action scenes aren't as sharp or to the point. Yeah. They run a bit long. They feel elongated by a second or two. You feel something is off. While other scenes, again, like the locker room scenes, which is absolutely, I think it's fantastic, and I love how it's incorporating Bob Wall. Some scenes just look, they're not as tight as you expect from Sammo, even in 1978, where he was already an accomplished action director and had just started his directing career. So I have a feeling that Robert Klaus and crew were still in there calling the shots and weren't about to let Sammo run free in all action scenes, you know.
The thing with this movie, I think, is that it's, despite its flaws, we have to kind of give credit where credit's due for some of the influential legacy that it created. I mean, especially, I know that years later when I got into video games, for example, you know, there's a game called Kung Fu Master arcade game that came out, which was basically this movie, right? It was, well, at least not the newly created 78 parts, but the earlier parts, right? The parts that were laid out by Bruce, you know, scaling up this pagoda and fighting a level boss, right? I mean, this is where we get the concept, really, of a level boss from Bruce Lee. And, you know, so people who play video games and understand the nature of the level boss, I think we tie it back to this film. I mean, I can't think of anything that comes to mind that sort of predates this idea.
Is that the Kung Fu game that was released in the West on the Nintendo Entertainment System as Kung Fu?
No. This is pre-Nintendo. This is back in the 80s when you had arcades and, you know, putting coins into machines. This was a coin-op machine, and it was simply called Kung Fu Master. You have a guy, very basic colors. He goes across the level and you know, fights, you know, random guys with kicks and punches, and then as he gets to the end of that level, there's a boss, and each boss is a different kind of style, and if he beats the boss, you climb up the stairs and you're up on the next level, and you get at the top and you're trying to rescue a girl. And so yeah, that was, I think, a direct, you know, game influence that came from this film. One of my favorite Shaw Brothers films, the Heroes of the East, too. I always got a similar kind of feel because in that you've got Gordon Liu, right, who's married to, he gets an arranged marriage to a Japanese wife, and they go back and forth about which is better, Japanese martial arts or Chinese martial arts. And then he ends up having to fight like four or five of her relatives from Japan, and they're each a different style, and he constantly has to sort of modify, you know, his style and be adaptable to be able to defeat them. And I think that adaptability was one of the key themes that Bruce was trying to work with.
Because, yeah, like the template for Game of Death wasn't unknown. Like, it was out in the public what Bruce was attempting. So therefore, you have good examples like that and the Bruce Lee copy movies also being climbing pagoda movies, some of them more successful and some of them just absolutely dull, as this is.
And of course, we then get, you know, some of the much later homages one might mention, like, for example, Jackie Chan's City Hunter. Yeah. He has to, you know, fight tall African men at the same time that Bruce Lee is seen as being projected
and talking to
cinema. You know, one wonders if, you know, there's a bit of stereotyping going on there or if it's just purely homage on the sake of.
Well, it is Wong Jing after all. So, you know, I guess it's as good as mine, how profound his thoughts were. You know, it's not awful that how they incorporate Bruce Lee's footage. Early in the movie, they talk of a character called Charlie Wang, which is the James Chen character, and they talk of him trying to take on the Syndicate, I suppose. And you cut to a brief portion of his fight with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and he dies, you know. So because he was part of the original movie and the footage that still exists, James Chen is there. It's not sparkling with fun and entertainment, this movie. It's too serious, and it doesn't have any dramatic or romantic chops. And its strength, after all is said and done, is in the trivia that it represents in movie history. It's a tough watch, that therefore, like, it's short, yeah, I give it that. And for work, it's kind of easy to go through. They wanted partly also a Hong Kong feel in the action, and that wasn't like... they weren't able to elevate to a Hong Kong action feel. You know, it happens sometimes when you bring Hong Kong onto the international stage, despite this being Golden Harvest as well, that some elements do get kind of watered down, because unfortunately we have examples throughout the ages where particular Western directors clash with Hong Kong action directors, because Hong Kong action directors are not looked at as favorably in the West. In Hong Kong, they are the man or the woman that runs the set while you do action. In the West, they're kind of a best stunt coordinator and the director is calling the shots. You have examples with James Glickenhouse and Jackie Chan not working out, and you have variations of the action footage in The Protector. Is it Protector? Yeah. I hope that has changed somewhat post Matrix and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon days, because I haven't really looked into how that relationship goes on an international production, you know, when they bring in, or if they bring in Asian talent to direct the action. But it's certainly evident here that Sam wasn't calling the shots at all times. But it throughout this continues to be like, you know, partly fun here and there, but then you get doubling that is so sloppy and unconvincing that you wonder if along the way they did indeed stop caring to make it convincing, because they had the business in their favor, part of it being pre-sold to Japan, and that they didn't really, or couldn't maybe, really elevate this to like an exciting time that really is going to change the game. But yeah, it's a problematic movie that isn't really fun to follow. I guess we should touch upon two things here, the bad taste parts and the unintentional dark parts that mirror the reality. Well, we should actually mention the scene at the set first, because Mel Novak, part of the Syndicate, gets himself onto what is the Fist of Fury set. I mean, they replicate the scene that is in Fist of Fury or in this movie, but they're not calling it Fist of Fury. And it's the end scene where Bruce Lee gets shot by the police, right? And Mel Novak is there, and he receives the blanks from the movie crew, but exchanges it for real bullets and shoots Billy Lowe in the face, which is unfortunate, not premonition, but mirroring of real life, as this is sort of what happened on the set of The Crow. And obviously, this is not the makers of Game of Death's fault or anything. It's just kind of a sad scene to watch, to be honest. But it's not their fault. It's just you're just reminded in a sad way that life imitates art, unfortunately.
The really sad part here too is the line, right? There's the assistant director who's a foreign guy on the set. He walks around as they're getting ready to set up the shot. He says, his line is, "Gentlemen, these are blanks. Only aim upward. There's a wad of paper that comes out and can injure someone." And that is, you know, pretty much my understanding of what happened to Brandon Lee. I mean, it wasn't the wad of paper, but a piece of the casing that came with it that ended up injuring him. You know, it's almost unthinkable that this would be a line that would be written as a legacy film for his father who, you know, passed away. And then this would, you know, kind of be his fate, unbeknownst to anyone.
Both of them kind of at their peak, receiving one of the great... Bruce received, like, his biggest, greatest role, essentially, and biggest exposure with Enter the Dragon. And I don't remember much from The Crow. I remember liking it, but it was a step up for Brandon, I believe, after doing popular, but still, you know, sort of B-actioners. And here we got, a comic book adaptation.
Laser Mission, I think, and Showdown in Little Tokyo.
So it's so sad how it mirrors it all. And I don't know why, though, why the gunman needs to be there at all while they do that shot. They're behind the camera and shooting upwards, but they're not in the movie running two cameras. They're just running the camera towards the shooting Bruce's side, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's for dramatic license, of course, but it's one of those, like, wait a minute. You don't really need to be there. You don't even need to be standing there at all. But, you know, dramatic license is what it is. So, he is shot in the face, but he survives. He needs reconstructive surgery. But they decide to fake his death so he can investigate the syndicate and get back at them. You know, that's the generic plot. And they stage his death. And therefore, you see footage from Bruce Lee's, what I assume is, you know, it's public funeral. Or they sort of, pardon me if it sounds dumb, but because I don't know how funeral structure and arrangement can be worked out, but it's clearly the casket anyway. It's paraded is maybe the wrong word, but it was done in public anyway with an open casket, and you had a documentary crew there shooting, which I'm sure were allowed to be there to shoot it for documentary purposes while the mourners and public was there and the police were trying to hold them off. And I guess that, you know, for documentary purposes, I think it's fine, but it's not fine when you take the same footage and use it for your little silly fictional movie. It's not okay, but because if they would have excluded a shot of Bruce Lee in the coffin, I would have been a little bit more forgiving, I think. But they don't. And seeing him in the coffin, pale obviously, and made up and all of that, it leaves such a bad taste in my mouth. I mean, as Bay Logan said, you know, it's the only way to summarize it. What were they thinking?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I think it would have been much more palatable if they just left that one shot there. And it's only there for, like, I want to say a second or two, but it's enough for you to really, really, guys, I mean, because the buildup to that is really just the crowds of people in the street. I think standing out there to view the funeral procession and then some of the signage. What you don't see if you've seen other documentaries on the funeral, you don't see, for example, many of the celebrities.
Sammo is there, I remember.
Yeah, Sammo, Sekin, some of the female stars at the time. And so they don't use that, obviously, because then, you know, then you're paying royalties to those people for their likenesses, I guess. But that shot around that same period of him in the casket is there just for that second tune. And it's really, yeah, I guess, you know, back in the day, you know, they're just like, well, we bought the rights, we can do what we want now that we've got the footage, so, you know, just use it.
It's film business, all right, but sometimes it is okay to not do something, you know.
Here's the question and kind of the last point I have for all of this. Because they found the new footage, you know, the extended footage, they've got a lot more footage. And because of what they can do today with computer technology, recreation of people, is it beyond the realm of possibility that they could go back and put together a longer new cut for this film? You know, I mean, I'm thinking If maybe I'm not sure if you've seen it, the viral video that came out some years ago of Bruce Lee playing ping pong with a pair of nunchucks. You know, they can do this really amazing stuff today using, you know, computer graphics and facial recognition or facial capture software and these kinds of things. Could they do enough of that just in pieces and parts to take all of the new footage and put together sort of a more coherent sequencing for that? That would be something that I think could be an interesting experiment. I don't know if anybody would be willing to take it on, but...
I mean, there's always the interest is still there for Bruce Lee. They're putting him in games, as you said, and there's always, it seems, talk of more biopics. And I don't know, is the technology really there? I mean, it might be unfair, but just because I started watching it, what they did in Tron Legacy, recreating Jeff Bridges in 2010, anyway, it looked creepy. But I don't know if they're there yet in 2015 in terms of recreating someone that way.
Well, they did more of it. Yeah, I'm not sure. You probably didn't get out to see it in the last Terminator movie, where they go back and they create young Arnold, basically, as he looked in the first film. And there's still a bit of an uncanny valleyness for me to it. Other people who I know saw it said, oh, it's just like him. It's amazing, you know. So they've actually made progress since Tron Legacy. And I'm thinking maybe 4 or 5 years out, you know, the technology would be such that they could get it a little bit more seamless and they could go in and create a new cut.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I'm not craving for it really, but commercialism being what it is and film business being what it is, I'm sure that train of thought still exists. So whether in producers' heads only, and the Bruce Lee family or foundation or whatever, they seem to approve of, you know, as long as it isn't exploitation, it seems like they approve, you know, a decent amount of productions, you know, for to go ahead and all of that. But I'm a big fan of Bruce Lee, but I'm not personally craving it. It's the 40 minutes that we do get, and I have some notes on them. They're pretty great, and I'm happy that they are edited in the way that they are, because we get an idea of, I think Bruce had something brewing that was, could be both poignant and clever, but also really fun. Like, the Game of Death footage has uncut, if you will. Looks to be, it's really fun and playful too. And that's what, you can't really replicate that, I think. I mean, it's it might just peter out as a vision.
Mm.
But who knows? I mean, it's always going to be attempts at bringing back things and what have you. And for heaven's sake, they might remake it. You know, put a Bruce Lee, so to say, lookalike in a yellow tracksuit and just remake the damn thing. They might as well do that too. Like, you know, we know how it works out there. So, I mean, I've slagged the movie off as a revenge piece and thriller. I mean, it never gets really fun as the Bruce Lee double, you know, starts sporting a fake beard and disguises to make himself hidden and all of that, and therefore the doubling becomes a bit easier. But Robert Klaus never really makes the movie spark, as we said, other than in a couple of select action scenes and you know, some bursts of the cut to second long footage from elsewhere. There's a point where in the locker room where they cut to a brief way of the dragon footage just after he has defeated Bob Wall and kicked him into the locker. You cut to that shot that is from the alley fight in Way of the Dragon. In Game of Death, they dub it like, Bob Wall, you lose, or Carl Miller, you lose. And in Way of the Dragon, he has kicked someone and he says the technique he has used, like, dragon, da-da-da, something tail or whatever. And those brief cuts to Bruce, they work for me. Like there is a technique there to make that stuff work, but then they continue to be sloppy with the doubling. They don't really care to shoot Tong Long or any actor from behind. It's just essentially we see a couple of guys playing Bruce Lee. That's the problem. Like, that's what the audience is asking themselves. Why are there a couple of actors playing Bruce Lee here? We have Bruce Lee, got that guy, and also the guy who's quite a distinguished martial artist and doing all the kicking and acrobatics. So why are four people playing him? Like, it gets to that point, if you know what I mean, Paul, that it becomes less of an illusion, and who knows if they cared all throughout to make it a waterproof or bulletproof illusion.
You know, if we never do get a remake of this, I think the material here is ripe, though, for a Stephen Chow movie on this thing, this subject. You know, him playing a Bruce Lee type of kind of character who passes away suddenly, and then you know, has some footage out there, and then he plays also maybe a lookalike guy who's a little bit off and has to come in. And I guess it would be riffing a little bit kind of the way that King of Comedy did, you know, on the whole idea of the genre. I think that approaching this film as sort of the basis for the subject matter for another kind of spoof film would seem to be right up his alley.
Yeah, it's you just wouldn't have him in front of the camera. No, I just have a feeling that, I mean, as Steven said, that just on a minor tangent, that he has no desire to go back to acting, or he just plays it by ear sort of thing from project to project.
You know, I can't say with any certainty. I've heard different stories from different people. One of the stories that I've heard more frequently than others is that he's burned too many bridges with a lot of local talent. And
Chola Chung, do you still like me?
So he's, I guess he's just more focused on the, you know, the behind the scenes, and he's getting, like many, you know, it's not just him, but like many, he's looking more to the market of the mainland than anything else. But apparently we are getting a co-production with him. With him and Tsui Hark for the next another Monkey King film. So that's, you know, that could be exciting. Again, he's behind the camera for this, but yeah, it would be an interesting collaboration.
I even saw that movie, like I saw a recent movie for once, decent enough. I wasn't totally blown away by it, but had its moments. But let's talk a little bit about the last 10 minutes of the film. That's where we get the Bruce Lee footage. There's not food that he shot for Game of Death. There's not 40 minutes here as Robert Klaus and crew decided to edit it the way they liked. And I even heard on the commentary Bay Logan referencing, and I'm not saying it's 100% true, I'm just saying what he was conveying, that Robert Klaus wasn't really a fan of the footage as such, and they decided to use less and less of it as the production went on, and kind of just used the basics as the Billy Lowe character arrives at, in the movie, it's a restaurant that has upper levels, right? It's a restaurant in the middle of Hong Kong that has tons of complex levels. Whether that's realistic or not, you don't really care. It's a restaurant, and he goes upstairs, and boom, there's Bruce Lee. And the build-up to the fights and the exchanges between him and initially Danny Inosanto are wonderful. Bruce was really, I think, he had his own train of thoughts, but also was very influenced by Japanese cinema, how you build up fights and really keep them to really sparse beats, you know what I mean? Like it's not full on Lao Gaolong, Jun Wo Ping fighting for 10 minutes. It's very alluring how they size each other up and how he manages to get his, you know, the slices into Inosanto's forehead with a little bamboo stick or whatever he's got as he comes up the level, which is actually something he's handed in the uncut footage. The nunchucks are handed to him, but you never see that in Game of Death. He just has the nunchucks, because in the finished footage, we don't see any reference to, in the Game of Death footage as finished in 1978, we don't have any reference to other characters being in the same room as Bruce Lee other than the fighters. So they use some editing to remove that. My favorite fight, and I think many others, I think it's the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar fight, which is the top level. It seems like that was the final level or next to last level. And it's a concept that works because of that size that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar brings, but he comes off as really powerful. And this, how Bruce has to adapt, this becomes really primal at the end. He just needs to strangle him essentially and hope he wins. Like, he's so invincible. And Bruce Lee, you thought, was kind of invincible. They really look good together. I think Kareem Abdul-Jabbar looks great and follows the rhythm that Bruce requires out of him quite well, actually. It is my favorite fight scene. The middle one is a bit less so, with the Korean gentleman. I forgot the name of him. But Danny Inosanto one is very good. But when he gets to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the concept comes to life really well, I think. So that's my favorite one. Even in edited form here, it's quite shortened versus the longer stretch of footage that's available as supplements elsewhere.
Part of the reason why I agree with you, I like the fight with Dan and also with Kareem more than the fight with the Korean martial artist. I think it's because there's a chemistry, or not really maybe a chemistry, but a familiarity with them, because they, like, Kareem was actually Bruce's student. So I think that they had a familiarity to working together, and that comes across well. And the same for Dan, right? So I think that's part of the reason why those maybe work a little bit better, at least for me, on what I'm shown on screen, is that that sense seems to come through in their physicality together. And yeah, the size difference is amazing in some of the shots, the way that they're put together. And you mentioned sort of his shift to becoming much more of a primal fighter. I think that's arguably what he's going for, right? His idea of sort of having to go and break away from what's considered the formal and the routine of traditional Chinese martial arts. That's kind of what he was all about. And that's why that's sort of the penultimate fight, I think, for the Tower of Death or Pagoda of Death or whatever you want to call it.
I mean, it might go, and I say might because I have not studied Jeet Kune Do, but I always understood it as it's, and he's quoted as saying this both in movies and outside of movies, that it's a style that has no style, which means it seems therefore approachable to a lot more people that wanted to practice some kind of martial arts. Jeet Kune Do kind of seemed to invite them into training and to adapt to that style of thinking, that it's a style that has no style, it's a bit more open, which I'm sure wasn't popular in some circles with traditional martial artists. But again, I might be talking out of my ass here. I'm not an expert on the philosophy and the content of the style.
No, yeah, I mean, if you understand too that he's coming from Wing Chun initially, right? With if you've had so many Ip Man films, it's impossible to forget that fact, right? But Wing Chun itself is a very sort of fixed style. It's got a tradition. It has very traditional forms. It's a lot of repetition and routine and doing the form so much that, practice makes perfect. His idea later in life, as he explored different forms of martial arts, was about being more adaptable, about breaking away from the rigidness of a lot of forms. Because, with Wing Chun, that's what you learn. If you learn, a family style like, Lao family style or Hong family style, that's what you learn. If you learn Shaolin Five Animal, it's doing the forms and maintaining the proper form and not questioning, not sort of breaking away, not suggesting, alternatives, because the form has tradition and you don't question the tradition. And so I think the interesting thing beyond the martial arts aspect is the filmic aspect. Because one of the reasons I think he's so successful and shot up so fast was because he took that same philosophy about martial arts and self-defense and he applied it to fight choreography. And so he, what you see in his films, especially the later films, is far more dynamic and visceral than what we see in the tradition of Shaw studio martial arts films. And it has a completely different look and feel when he's doing action on the screen and when he's in charge of the action on the screen than if we go and we look at, a Lao Kalung movie or something that's shot in that sort of very traditional Shaw long take style. And that's not to say that his is superior or not. I mean, I love both. It's a different sensibility that he's going for, and it was popular at the time because it was something different.
It really stands out in an otherwise, like, even in The Big Boss, which is just a pretty boring movie other than Bruce's contributions, which just stands out heads and shoulders above anything that the competition was doing, because it's certainly not Lo Wei, the director that elevates those movies. No way. No way, Lo Wei. But yeah, I mean, he was so on his way with Game of Death. I haven't seen Enter the Dragon since I was a kid, so I don't know how it came off in Enter the Dragon, his style. Do you remember that offhand, if it's felt like this is Bruce's show, or what was the Western, Warner Brothers and Robert Klaus and the likes, you think, steering how action was shot and presented?
It's hard for me to remember because, again, it's been a while since I've seen many of these films. I need to go back and rewatch. I've seen The Big Boss fairly recently. And so, yeah, I do agree. With that film, I'm kind of watching the whole thing just going, break the damn amulet already.
Yeah, it takes 4 to 5 minutes.
So it's, yeah.
He got you, man. He got you, dude. Like, that's what they were going through. Like, we're going to wait. We're going to tease you. We're going to wait. It must be worse knowing what Bruce Lee was about and what he could to watch that. Like, come on. Oh my God, no, we can do it. Do it.
I definitely think that he, as he matured and as he got more creative control, we get a lot more excitement, to be sure.
I really think Game of Death would have panned out. It felt like it could have panned out really well. Like, clearly, they were going for the pagoda climbing to be a centerpiece of it all. Seeing as we have 40 minutes here as edited based on his script notes and what have you. But also, obviously, we didn't know exactly how much he had planned fight-wise before and after the footage as it stands now. But that actually leads us into... I pulled the original plot summary from the internet, and I hope the Wikipedia one is right. What would Bruce Lee's Game of Death, what would it have been about? And apparently it goes a little bit something like this. And this is a quote. The original plot involves Lee playing the role of Hai Tien, a retired champion martial artist who was confronted by the Korean underworld gangs. They tell him the story of a pagoda where guns are prohibited and under heavy guard by highly skilled martial artists who are protecting something which is not identified by the surviving material. And that something is held on its top level, whether it's a boss or what have you. The gang boss wants Hai to be a part of a group whose purpose is to retrieve said item. So it is maybe an item. They would be the second group to do so, as the first attempt with a previous group had failed. And when Hai refuses, his younger sister and brother are kidnapped, forcing him to participate, hence all the fights. And Hai, as well as four other martial artists, two of which are played by James Chen and Chi Yuan. Then fight their way up a 5-level pagoda, encountering a challenge on each floor. So essentially we have 3 on film, almost complete. Danin Santo, the Korean martial artist, and Kareem. That's what we have. And in the uncut footage, as they've dubbed it afterwards, both in the Hong Kong Legends footage, and also there's a different dub, I believe, in the A Warrior's Journey documentary. After he's defeated Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, he has broken the windows by that point, and he's sensitive to light, and he shouts down to people on the ground saying, like, you know, I can't do this anymore, you have to. And I think they reference the fact that he must fight outside at one point too. So maybe outside is sort of a 5th level or 4th level. So there is some dialogue still connecting to the plot that they've interpreted based on mouth movements, because some of the dialogue was clearly in English, and if it was in Chinese, I think they had script notes that they based some of their determinations on. But that was essentially the sort of simple plot of Game of Death. But again, to summarize it all, I think it would have turned out great. I have a feeling it would.
And a pretty amazing cast was lined up too. I mean, you have George Lazenby, one time James Bond.
Stoner. Fuck James Bond. Stoner. He played Stoner, dude.
Bolo Young, Sammo Hung, Yun Biao. Jackie Chan is listed as a potential fan who asks for Hai Tien or Bruce Lee's autograph. Betty Ting, Nora Miao. So it sounds like they had a lot out on paper in terms of what was supposed to be done. And this is, I think, the sadness for me. I think it was a documentary called, I want to say Bruce Lee, The Legend. There's quite a few. I always get the names mixed up. But in that one, they found some, I guess, some press photos or some, you know, something like you'd see in an agent's, you know, actor's kit, mm-hmm. of him dressed up in like period costumes for, you know, doing different roles. You know, I just remember seeing those and thinking, wow, I mean, the stuff we could have had, you know, the stuff, the potential that was there. I remember seeing elsewhere that he was apparently in talks with James Coburn, who I think was also a student of his, to do a movie. I think that was called The Magic Flute or The Silent Flute. Yeah. And, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, because I love James Coburn. James Coburn and Bruce Lee in a movie together, that would have been so amazing. For me, I think much more tragic than this film, this mishmash that we've been talking about, is all that potential out there that is just, you know, was never able to manifest itself.
Yeah, it seems like good intentions, you know, for projects that would have been worthwhile rather than like, hey, we're like you Kung Fu kid, appear in our Kung Fu movie. Like, it seems like they would have been fought out before they went into production. It seems he had that pull. No wonder, seeing he was such a big box office draw.
I had the biggest hate for David Carradine throughout a good portion of my life, simply because I knew early on that Bruce was supposed to be in the role of Kane in Kung Fu, and I could never watch that series.
Was he up for it seriously, or did he just audition?
Well, no, he was the co-creator of that series,
right.
And then they didn't they finally pulled. They said they couldn't go with Bruce because they didn't think that America would watch an Asian male lead. I've since gained more respect for David Carradine. I love Death Race 2000 and his comeback in things like Kill Bill and stuff. But there was just the longest time when I couldn't stand to see him because of that associative fact. But the really truly sad thing is that legacy kind of still is true. Russell Wong, Michael Wong's brother, he had a spin, I want to say in the 90s, with a thing called Vanishing Sun. And Vanishing Sun was part of this action-packed deal with Hercules, the Kevin Sorbo Hercules,
right.
the Xena series. I might be thinking incorrectly. It was also William Shatner's Tech War at the time. They were all given this five pilot movie run, right? As part of this thing. It was called the Saturday Action Pack or something. So it was kind of like these 5 2-hour movies that were done. And then out of that, we got, of course, long-running series for Sorbo's Hercules and Lucy Lawless later in the Xena spinoff from that. And Vanishing Sun just vanished.
Disappointed!
Yes, indeed. And that was this great, if you've never seen it, it was this sort of great story where Russell Wong was like this, his family was, I think they were refugees after Tiananmen, and he was doing martial arts. And then he had this brother who was getting involved in triads in LA or somewhere, and it had so much potential, and it was back when Russell was younger and fitter, and he still had his dancer's body, and I was so looking forward to that taking off, and it just didn't. And again, I think it's because of this whole, or maybe it's not just a myth, maybe it's still part of the American public's problem, is that they don't want to watch Asian male leads. And I can't think of a show that runs with an Asian male lead now. The closest thing you've got is Walking Dead with Steve Yeun. And he's not really technically the main character. He's part of the main group, but...
Well, you got the upcoming Daniel Wu thing, I suppose.
Yeah, the Daniel Wu thing. I'll be interested to see how that...
Badlands,
yeah. That takes off or not. So, yeah, maybe things are changing. I just read today that the new Incredible Hulk is... it's not the Incredible Hulk. It's the Amazing Awesome Hulk is a Korean character.
Right on. Is that different from the regular Hulk, the Amazing Awesome Hulk?
it's a new Hulk. I think the series is starting in Marvel this winter. It's not a reboot, so it's not the character's not Bruce Banner. He's like this young kid scientist. I don't know his character's name, but he gets irradiated and becomes a Hulk, basically. So Korean Hulk, which could be awesome. I don't know if we'll see that in the Avengers movies in my lifetime or not. But, so this kind of stuff is slowly starting to change. Whether it takes hold, whether it takes root or not, we'll have to wait and see. But, even today, decades after Bruce Lee, look at Jason Scott Lee, who was playing the Bruce Lee role in Dragon. I think he did, what did he do? He did one of the Universal Soldier movies. He had a couple small roles, but he had very, a very difficult time trying to make it as a leading man in Hollywood.
Indeed, yeah. It's reserved for a couple of ones, but even the biggest ones can't always break the market. Looking at Chow Yun-Fat, and now it's more of a mix, back and forward between English and Chinese or Mandarin entertainment only. let's put a cap on it and talk availability really quickly. It's always been well distributed. I may not be in love with the movie, but if I see a cheap Laserdisc of it, I'm getting that in a heartbeat, because it'll be much cooler to have on Laserdisc, at least. It's just my kind of a nerdy train of thought. I want to have Game of Death on Laserdisc. I'll buy the score, for heaven's sake. I think it's John Barry's score is good enough. But anyway, it's got both imprint, DVD and Blu-ray releases in Hong Kong, but knowing that it's coming from Fortune Star, Satan, as I call them, I'm not a fan of Fortune Star, chances are that it's an upscale from a DVD and not high definition. And Also, looking at the specs, it looks like it's remixes only and no mono option available. Even the DVD is 5.1 remixed only, and Fortune Star's track record with remixes, it's pretty much terrible. New effects are going to stand out like a sore thumb and really poorly done, just like Celestial did poor remixes. But there are some good news. Reportedly, Japan put out a Blu-ray fairly recently with that Fortune Star transfer as the main component, but on it, because the Blu-ray has the space for it, as a supplement, they include an HD version of the international edit of Game of Death that we watched, and therefore it's in English, that is from a 35mm Japanese cinema print, meaning it's got some damage, burned in Japanese subtitles, and I've seen that version, and it looks quite splendid for the movie that it is. So there exists a true HD version of it on Blu-ray, albeit in Japan. And there's also a Blu-ray release in the US by Shout Factory as part of their Bruce Lee Legacy collection. And I've heard conflicting reports whether this or any other movies in the set, if they were true HD. Yeah. But because they were working with Fortune Star, I think, you know, well, I wouldn't spend $100 on it before researching it. It might not be the greatest upgrade from DVD that it seems like. That's it. Next time, because this was such a meaty discussion, and I favor brevity nowadays for these shows, when I can anyway, we are going to discuss a single movie next episode as well, namely the loose sequel to Game of Death, called Tower of Death, aka Game of Death 2. It's finally something riffing on Bruce's cinematic image that becomes goofy mad fun. And Bruce Lee's double gets to be on screen for real this time, not just sloppily shot to make us believe it's totally Bruce Lee we're watching, but he's actually the star of the film, essentially. And with me for that discussion next week of Tower of Death will be Paul Fox as well. So I've roped him in for a double bill of Game of Death. But that's for next episode. So that's that. Let's finish this one off then. This has been Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. Find our shows on podcastonfire.com. Our email, if you have any questions or feedback, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. Follow the links to our social media at the top of our page, our various Facebook and Twitter. And once you're on Facebook, join the discussion group to engage in the little fan community that we have. Our Twitter handle is @podcastonfire. I write about Hong Kong movies, Taiwanese movies, ninja movies, and a variety of genres over at sogoodreviews.com. And I video review at sleazykvideo.com, and my Twitter handle is @sogoodreviews. And you can stream us, rather, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you have the time and know your way around iTunes, rate and leave us a small written comment about what you thought of this show or Bruce Lee or what have you. Like one or two sentences will do. That'll be sufficient enough for a review. And finally, Stitcher Radio is the place to stream us, either on their website or if you download the free applications available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. And your plug for your podcast as well, Paul.
Yeah, you can find everything we do over at Kongcast.com. That's KONGCAST.com. So just check us out over there to see what's up.
Current Hong Kong releases or current Western movies appearing in Hong Kong theaters as they speak. Like you get your current fix over at East Screen, West Screen, and Comcast.com, which I am very appreciative of, even if I never seen Wild City 2 or 4 and or Minions for that matter. Like but you review them all, so there you are. Like I'm the only person in the world who didn't know where those little cheesy puffs came from, because I haven't seen any of those movies. Like so, when you reviewed it, it was like, oh, okay, gotcha. I get why they're popular, I guess, but still, like they're like cheesy puffs with glasses. Like what's that about? But they're probably good. Like, what is it, the movie that came out of Despicable Me? Is that where they came out of?
Yes, Despicable Me is the franchise.
You can probably watch it on Netflix now, but then forever and forever, forever and ever. But I choose to podcast instead. So there it is. But thank you, Paul, for the delightful and insightful discussion on Game of Death. So I hope to, we'll see you next week, you and I, to discuss the Tower of Death. We're going to an underground tower this time. We're not climbing upwards, we're climbing downwards, kind of. Thank you very much, Paul, and say goodbye to listeners.
Bye-bye.